Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is episode 15 in the Crossroads of Countries. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. The Freedom Writers often told me that they felt that they were living in an undeclared war. Dodging bullets in the streets and running from rival gangs, tragically, were a normal part of their everyday lives. Because of this incredibly violent reality, my students related to stories of other young people who had lived in actual war zones. The Diary of Anne Frank about the Holocaust and World War II, and Zlata's Diary, A Child's Life in Sarajevo, about the Bosnian Genocide, were books that inspired my students to pick up a pen instead of a gun and share their stories with the world. Today's episode explores how violence affects children and the plight of refugees of all ages around the globe. We examine the long-lasting scars, both visible and unseen, that violence leaves by sharing striking stories from survivors who experienced war firsthand. Most importantly, we discuss ways we can help refugees today, both abroad and on our own soil, especially within our classrooms. First, you'll hear from Bunny Sek, an original freedom writer and the daughter of survivors of the Cambodian genocide. This clip is from an event where she addressed an audience of students and freedom writer teachers at Westmoreland High School in upstate New York as part of a panel of genocide survivors. Bunny explains what it was like being born in a refugee camp in Thailand and recounts her experience being raised in America in the aftermath of such a tragedy. Next, for our diary of the day, we have an excerpt from our book, The Freedom Writer's Diary, about the haunting impact of violence on one of my students. And finally, for our feature discussion, we bring you my conversation with Geir Duwaney, an actor and activist, and known by many as one of the Lost Boys of Sudan. When Geir was only 7 years old, his family fled his village in South Sudan and walked for 3 months to a refugee camp in Ethiopia. Geir recounts in compelling detail the steps of his journey and the challenges he and his family faced. He also paints a vivid picture of what life as a refugee is like, as a child, an adolescent, and now as an adult. I hope that you are touched and moved to action by Geir's words. My invitation is for you to listen with an open heart and think of the 65 million people around the world today of all countries, colors, and creeds seeking asylum from war and persecution. As you will hear Geir express so beautifully, there is so much to do, there is so much to learn, and we can all do something to help. Now, here's Bunny.
I was born in a refugee camp and survived there for 2 years. I get to hear all the time about my parents' stories and how heartbreaking it is, the struggle that they had to go through. You're sleeping on the ground, you're battling the elements, being sickly and being scared, crying all the time and being hungry, not knowing, you know, what to expect the next day. It's all about survival and, you know, dad's going off to work while my mother had to take care of myself and my little sister.
Eventually, my parents moved here to America, and that's where I was raised. But there was always this dark part of my parents' past hanging over our family.
You know, you guys get tucked in at night and you read bedtime stories. That doesn't exist in my culture. There's no I love yous. There are no birthdays. There are no toys. There's no Christmas. So my upbringing and having to see a culture that was so drastically different, people with clothes and nice shoes to wear and pretty hair, and just being happy and carefree, the dynamic of my upbringing, my childhood was so different. There was this disconnect between my parents and I because emotionally they weren't there to give me the love and the nurturing that I needed. But I had to change that story. I had to rewrite that for my family. I changed the course of my life as well as my mother's, who is now more open and more talkative now, you know, mom says, I love you. She says good night, and she hugs and she kisses, and we celebrate Thanksgiving. We do Christmas. There's a lot of joy and love now.
I'm just really honored to be with you guys tonight
because you guys get to follow me on that journey of going back in time and reliving my experiences with me.
Don't ever forget, no matter what happened to you or your family, you can change your story too.
Bunny often shares her family's story of fleeing Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge and the genocide that followed at Freedom Rider events all over the country. Her goal is to help teachers and students better understand what refugee children might be going through. As you heard Bunny explain, there are so many cultural, social, and spiritual factors to be considered when trying to support these students, and every case is different. Because of the diverse backgrounds of my students, the Freedom Riders Foundation is in a unique position to provide insight and experience to empower you as an educator, parent, mentor, or student. The Freedom Riders are here to serve you and support you and help you make a difference. If you want to learn more about bringing a Freedom Rider to your school or organization, please reach out to us. Send us an email at podcast@freedomridersfoundation.org. And we'll connect you with the ideal Freedom Rider to share their story with your audience. Now, here is our diary of the day, diary number 69 from the Freedom Rider's Diary. It will be read by Freedom Rider Dustin Infante.
Dear Diary, as I looked up at the sky, there seemed to be a black cloud lingering over my neighborhood, even on the sunniest day. I pictured myself coming home to a wonderful house with white picket fences, but slowly my picture starts to fade. Instead of reading about gang violence in the newspapers, I'm the kid you see on the news telling a reporter what I've witnessed. At 16, I probably witnessed more dead bodies than a mortician. Murder plays a big role in my neighborhood. Every time I step out of my front door, I'm faced with the risk of being shot. Just recently, while I was sound asleep, I awoke to the sound of gunshots. It was 2:30 in the morning. After the gunshots stopped, a woman screamed, "Help me, please!" I looked out of my bedroom window to see a man with a bullet wound in his head the size of a quarter and blood oozing out of his head like ketchup coming from a Heinz bottle. It's easier for me to pretend I don't live where I live or see what I see. I sit in my room wishing I could fly away from all of the madness. Writing about my pain will only make it worse.
Whether it's a war raging in Africa, gangs running rampant in American cities, or any of the untold instances of abuse and persecution taking place on every continent, every day, violence in all its forms will continue leaving scars. It will persist in its destructive patterns unless we do something about it. During their time in Room 203, the Freedom Riders persevered through pain, trauma, and fear, and they helped each other share their stories, seek help, and heal. They learned to speak up and stand up together. And against all odds, many of them escaped lives of violence. They used education as a means of making their lives better, and now they are giving back. Though unmoored from the familiar streets of their undeclared war zones, they are now anchored in their collective purpose to write, to teach, and to inspire. It's time for our featured discussion. Recorded at the Scholastic headquarters in New York City, here's my candid conversation with Gayer Duaney. They often say that history is written by the folks who win wars, but what happens when the war is not finished? How is that story told? who writes that narrative, and I think the most important thing is to give those who live that narrative the opportunity to share their truth, to share their story. So I am honored to shed light on a very dark subject that is still unfolding. The name of his country has changed. His people are still displaced. But where he calls home is currently the South Sudan. Sitting beside me to teach me and to teach all of our listeners is my dear friend, Gare Duwayne.
Thank you, Heron. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you.
For our listeners who are unfamiliar with the conflict, can you describe the origin of your country and where you were born?
I was born November 9th, 1978. You know, there has been many wars in Sudan. Sudan is a colony of British. And the surrounding of the Sudan, before even split, you know, of course, we were surrounded by nine countries. So Egypt, Libya, Chad, Central Africa, Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, and then Mediterranean Sea. And I think also there's Zaire back then. So there's a lot of classification that happened because of this unrest. Yeah, civil war started in 1955, you know, before we became independent nation from Egypt, because we had our independence from Egypt when the British left us under Egypt, and then Sudan was given the right for it to be an independent nation in 1956. So before 56, the South Sudanese, we wanted to govern ourselves, but we were given that opportunity. So the civil war happened from when my father was a young man, and our mother, my mom, of course. And then the war went on for over 17 years. And then by the time my family get to have us, and then the civil war stops. When I look into the history of Sudan, we never really had peace for more than 10 years minimum before another civil war tip over. Look at the war that happened in 1955 and then it ended in 72. If you think about the peacetime that they have between 1972 and 83, is only 10 years minimums. And then another war happened, and then from 83 to 2005, you see? And then again, you know, from 2011 when we became independent nation, and now is another. So there's a pattern here that the wars always happen in Sudan or South Sudan every other 10 years.
What was it like to be born in a country that was in transition?
The second civil war actually happened in 1983. That's when it became a movement, armed movement, that really fighting the North Sudan in order for us to not to be a second class citizen in our country. So that's when I was a small boy, maybe around age of 7 to 8. And I came to realize that, you know, my country was going through civil war because we had to be removed out of the city all the way to a village. And then that took time, you know, before my father really joined the freedom fighters who really pick up arms to fight against the North for the freedom of our people. I was in a village, and then I get to see the airplanes, like helicopters, military helicopter, come into the area, and then we have to hide in the bushes. And that's when I realized something is not going right in the country. We always prepare for everything, especially, you know, when the fight really happened, and then as a civilian you get caught in a crossfire. And that happened plenty of times. But at the same time, we always manage to live our lives, even when there's war. So I managed to play as a small kid, going to the forest and hunting for birds and get to know insects and play with my age mates. And yeah, I think I had a decent childhood in a village, even though the war was happening at the same time.
The Freedom Riders, when they were teenagers, used the phrase living in an undeclared war. You know, there was guns on the street and there was rival gangs, and they always felt like they were a target. You, however, lived in a true declared war where there's tanks and AK-47s. For you as a child, having that be your reality, did you even know what war meant? What, as a kid, how do you frame that?
Well, a war means people gonna lose life, family will not come back. and we were witnessing that. Because I grew up around guns, you know, within my own house, the household that I lived in. My father owned so many guns because he's a soldier. And then, but not only that, I had just had a fascination with guns when I was young, and I just couldn't wait to get old enough and have the strength to really earn one of those. And then when I earned one of those, then I was, you know, I was, it's like you're untouchable. You have a different feelings. You know, you fear not so much as a small boy. So I use gun a lot, and it become a hobby for me to even operate the gun and put it into many small pieces and put it back together. In Sudan, everybody in the 80s and 90s when I was there, and then all of us, everybody have a gun. So whether you are in the military or you know how to use it properly or not, you know, everybody learned it in a hard way. And many people lost their lives, you know. I can remember one time, you know, operating a gun, and my little sister was right next to me, and then it just blew up and almost killed both of us. It's because I don't have a proper way of understanding it, but it is in my hands, you know. No one has really given me a provision not to do what I'm not supposed to be doing as a small boy. It was about surviving and also to take responsibility to protect myself and my mother and my siblings around me. And then the gun was accessible to all of us.
You talk about being a refugee. How did you get displaced? And what does that mean to you to be a refugee?
Well, it means that I have no home. Being a refugee means that I have to accept any other homes that give me an opportunity, and I have to integrate myself in that society. And I have to do it very fast.
Wow.
I have to adapt, I have to learn, and then I have to give back something.
And to get from where you lived in the Sudan to Ethiopia, was that a march? Were you going through the plains? Describe what that would look like to be forced out of your village. And the only thing you own is what you can carry.
Well, villages, there was always war. We were living in a barracks close to like military area where my father was. So that barrack was attacked by enemies, you know, the government of Sudan and the rebel within the region. So my family, we decided to join refugee camps, and it's an instant decision, you know. It's not something that you have to sit down and really try to map it out on how to really go there. No, it just happened. You left no clothes, just you. And, you know, Sudan is the largest country in Africa at the time before it split into two nations now, which is north and south. So geographically, there's people that come maybe 1,000 miles away by foot because there's no airplane at all, no cars at the time. Even there's no infrastructure until now as we're speaking today. So we have to, everybody have to march from that area. And then the Civil War gave me a sense of how big my country is, because many people come from Nuba Mountains all the way in central Sudan, and some come from the west, from the east, and all around our area. So going toward Ethiopia to one big refugee camps, and then that's when I get to see all the ethnic groups of Sudan. So all of us have to just march toward Ethiopia, you know. You just go toward the rising sun. I used to be like, we walk toward the rising sun. I don't know how far the sun is, but it seemed like that's where we're gonna get lights at some point. We move very slowly as a family because we have small kids, and some of our mothers, they were giving birth at the same time. So we have to move very slowly, and it took us maybe about 3 months. You know, walking long distance without adequate water is not really an easy thing. And maybe with little food or no food at all. And shoes is a luxury that I didn't really have. There's time that my toenails, they're not there. Even now, I still have scars in my feet. There's dry season and there's flood season. We have done both. You know, there's day that you are walking in a desert where there's no water. And there's time that, you know, you have to walk in a flood where the water is up to here.
Up to your chest.
Yeah, you can imagine walking through that maybe throughout the whole day. And where you have no place to sleep, you know? You can be sleeping standing.
How How does a mother with a baby holding a hand of another child, I mean, I can't paint that picture of what that would look like for this caravan of people who are loving and protecting one another.
Mm. Mothers always do a fantastic job in this kind of civil war because they're the one that always have to lead the family out of the war. Fathers are always left in the war. So we all have to stick together, and we, you know, you have to follow mom. She's carrying things in her head, and you right behind her and holding small one hand. And if I was old enough where I can walk, you know, and I just had to follow everybody. So my mom was the one that was guiding us. And our people, they have a way to really figure out directions and how to navigate. And also, there's people that have experience that always travel, you know, from country to country doing trade. So
you are geographically finding your way from the village to Ethiopia. Did you tragically lose anybody on this very long walk?
I almost lost myself from dehydration because there was a time that we have to walk for over 4 days and we didn't really have water. By the time we find the water, and then I drink fast, and then almost water killed me. I was having pain in my stomach because it almost buzzed.
One of the things that was such a tragic image for people who were liberated from concentration camps during World War II was they were liberated, they were given food, they gorged, they ate too much, and then their body couldn't adapt to the food.
That's
and,
true.
And ended up dying shortly after liberation.
Yes.
Describe that feeling of being parched, dehydrated, sore and achy, and do you come across a well? Do you come across a lake?
Yeah, we came across a nice lake, you know, and everybody just stumbled into a water, so no one is paying attention to one another. You know, even we were moving around with our cattle as well, you know, our livestock, which are really important to us at the time. And then everybody drinking, cows drinking, I'm drinking, and all of a sudden, you know, I try to get up, and then I'm just throwing up again. And then they're like, oh, Gary has drank so much water, you know. And I couldn't stop drinking water. I want to go right back in there, you know. I throw up, I want to go right back and get some more water. And there was plenty of people that was dying from drinking water because they just find the water, you know.
Did you ever find that the water that you found on this very long march had parasites? I love the fact that you would drink and eat anything for survival.
That's a very little thing that I can ever worry about, parasites or not. I can remember there was one battle in the summer camps that I was living in, and then many bodies used to just flow through the river at one time. And then I came to the Nile and I drank the water, and then the dead body was somewhere there. I didn't realize until by the time I finished drinking that I was just drinking water from the next to the dead bodies. Yeah, and that is normal. It's always happened to us. There's no season there you don't see bodies flow in the Nile. I didn't know clean water separate from the water that can poison me until later on.
To see carnage and death, and then to use the word normal because that was part of your existence, does that affect your dreams? Does that stay with you as a child? That image I just saw could be a loved one, could be me.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron, when so many people die, and then to a point, it's very difficult for people to bury people. And some people are looking for their loved ones, and then the only time that they can find someone is when they flow through the water and they go pull it, if you recognize as your person. Because it's important in our culture for us to bury our dead. Always very important things. And then I think that made it very difficult. The more people are dying, and sometimes the birds, they feed off of dead bodies, and then people of South Sudan find it very difficult. It was normal to see a dead body just about anywhere that perished, maybe from guns or maybe from hunger or lack of having water or disease. These type of things happened to us in the 80s. But not only that, you know, even 2013, when the current civil war really happened, many people are dying like that right now
right
in
now.
The refugee camps, yes.
So when you were finally in Ethiopia at the refugee camp, did you feel safe? Was it a relief? Or was there more hardship?
Well, yes. After we went to Ethiopia in 87, I spent 4 years in refugee camps. I thought about school a lot because those days there's no facility for us to go and learn. So we have to have schools under the trees, and then we have to learn our ABCs from some of the soldiers that are hurt in the front line, and then we have some sort of education before the Civil War broke out, and then they taught me how to read, and then I was fascinated from readings and writing in my language, and the taste of that kind of drive me toward education all the time. And we also do our military drill because we were being indoctrinated toward becoming soldiers at some point. So our activities revolve around that at the time. So in my opinion back then, yeah, I felt a little bit safe. I find some sort of stability, meaning that there was no physical war that was happening, only just small violence here and there, and people lose their lives. But I remember it was a time where there's a lot of violence that happened to us in our own home. Our neighbors opened fire to us, and the guy just shot at me and my cousin and my father, like very close. But he missed me, and then he hit my cousin, and then he killed him, and then we buried him in a very shallow place. A few months later on, you know, even I was walking in the bushes while I was going after our cows, and his bones was out. And then I recognized him because his skull, you know. So I figured that, you know, sometimes there's animals at night that really get to the bodies, you know, in those refugee camps. And refugee camps, people die because of many different violence. Some people die because people have guns, you know. These people are soldiers in refugee camps. They kill each other. And some people die from diseases, terrible water, you know. So it used to be mass graves that they had to put bodies in there. Especially children always die in a bigger number, you know. So I used to see that it's a daily thing. If a day come up, you're gonna see a dead body one way or the other.
I think about my own journey of where I was, and I think of turning on my news or picking up a newspaper. Why didn't I read about this? Why didn't I see this? So do you feel that the world had forgotten you? Did you see reporters or cameras and hope that the world will find out and they will come help us?
I didn't know how big the world is, you know? I didn't know who cared. And one thing, let me tell you a story, because my younger brothers, they came last October.
To America.
Yeah, to America here. And they came here to New York City, and then I took them around to like World Trade Center to speak about the history of America, September 11. And then I also took them to Liberty Statue, so they get to see. But they just came from the war. And then we were standing on Times Square, and my younger brother said, like, all of these people that are moving so many directions, do you think they think about us in refugee camp in Kakuma? I was like, no, nobody think about that. Only are people thinking about fighting, but people here don't think about that people are really dying there. So the more I think about the history of our Civil War when I was in Civil War, and then I realized, so I could have been gone, and then there's no one person around the world that know what's really happening to us. And look, even now as we sit and we are talking, there's people that are really dying from hunger, from fightings, from torturings, and all the atrocities that are being committed on innocent women, children, older women, and no one really is speaking about it. It's like we go on about our day.
Can we talk about how you ended up coming to America? I think that's a very interesting story. So you're at a refugee camp, and how did the opportunity present itself to you that you could come to America and go to school?
You know, after Civil War broke out in Ethiopia, which is separate Civil War from Sudan, and then I vanished coming toward Kenya. So I stayed in a couple of refugee camps in East Africa, in Kenya. One of my opportunities came when I was in a refugee camp called Dadaab. It's in the border of Somalia and Kenya. So that's, it used to be one of the biggest refugee camps, and then I guess it came to the world attention that there's refugees in this location, and then we should be given an opportunity to settle here in America. So I wasn't sure how I was going to find my way, but somehow I had a guy from my clan or my ethnic groups that really put me in his form as one of his dependents, and that's how I really came here in May 1994. I was devastated when I first left that refugee camps and got an airplane to come to America and go to Iowa. That's when it finally rings in my head, like, whoa, this is the time in my life that I will never get to see my mom ever again. Because I wasn't sure if I come here, if I would be able to make it back. It devastated me. I think my first year in America, every night I cry. Because the thought of me going back, it was slim. But it's because I didn't know enough information. I didn't know that I can apply, have a citizenship, and then work and save some money, and then maybe travel and go back. But in 2008, it finally came to me, after I became a U.S. citizen in 2006, and then the thoughts of traveling to go back to my home started to come to me little by little, little by little.
Des Moines, Iowa was very different than Kenya, Ethiopia, and the South Sudan.
Absolutely, so yeah.
Did you feel embraced? Did the fine folk of Iowa take you in?
They took us in. They took us in very well. And then we have to work closely with the human services and then social services people. And then they took us around. They took us to our dentist, to our doctor appointments. I guess it was a job for them. And then it used to blow me away. Why? People are helping us, why are they so kind to us, you know? So it was so many things that was happening in my mind that I can't even imagine that I'm here. And while I was over there, and within short time, I could be in another world.
I love for our listeners to have access to history, and you were starring in a film about this very same subject with the Academy Award-winning actress Reese Witherspoon, called The Good Lie.
Yes.
And the context is Sudanese come to America and they go to a Midwestern state, and it's all of those things that oftentimes Americans take for granted, setting up a home, the kind of food that they eat, transportation. And so what was that like for you to, as an actor and an activist, to be portraying something that you actually did? Did you find the film accurate to some of the experiences that you went through?
Yeah, I think, yeah, it was accurate. I mean, you know, there's a culture shock in the films. And then when the scripts first came, and then the substance that need to make that story a bit more authentic. And then that's when we worked closely with the writer, Margaret Nago. And then I would say, yeah, I think this is small things needed. So I consult in the film in the best way that I can help. And yeah, of course, I have to revisit back, you know. Actually, in all the actors in their films, seem like I'm the only one that really went through that path, you know.
Cause, so you were the only Sudanese.
Yeah. That film kind of changed me, and you know, for a very long time, I have to take time to really think about it. Because, you know, I knew that my life is not going to be the same once I really do these films. But then I knew that I really need to revisit the past, you know, because I tend to walk away from it for a very long time. But now if I'm coming into it in another form of acting in the films, it was challenging for me. It was challenging for me because I have to go that far to see, you know, to bring back the violence, and I have to think about it. Had to pull from somewhere, somehow. And each time, you know, we do a scene, and then if it's not done properly, and then me going through it again, I used to hate that. Yeah. I just wanted to do it one time.
And move forward.
Finish that.
So let's talk about a feature film illuminated something for an audience that I think made you realize, I have a platform. So you've decided to dig deeper. You are now creating a documentary, a book that is being written, and you travel with speaking engagements. You have become a true storyteller, and the story that you're telling is still unfolding. So with all these different venues, constantly you are taking people on this journey backwards to your roots to say the problem has not been resolved. So what do people need to know who are listening to this podcast? This is another platform for you to say, listen, do, help.
Well, the thing that I always want people to know in every single Civil War is always a narrative that is always done based on the leaders that really lead those kind of war. One thing that this platform has given me, or should be given to a lot of people that really have similar story, is that it is good that we narrate our own story ourselves, you know. It's my life story, so it shouldn't be told by those who consider themselves liberator of the nations. So it's really important for all the young people to know that the world is bigger than what they may have in their surrounding right now. The same goes for me. I mean, I look at this Civil War as an opportunity for me to walk away from my own family and really completely find a different society where I can integrate myself and learn some things. A distraction like that can destroy you completely, or it can give you another opportunity to have a different outlook about life. I do, because I can't even imagine if this didn't happen, I won't be here. If the war didn't happen, I won't be pushing myself to go to cross borders without passport and to finding proper documents to go to a different society where I have to become a citizen of that nation. If the war didn't happen, I will never know this. I will never get to meet you. I will never get to talk to you. I will not know your story. We will not have the same citizenship together.
You put this beautiful, loving face to immigration, to folks who seek asylum and are refugees, at a time that often the banter and the discussion vilifies and makes people others, regardless of skin color, regardless of the soil they were born on. When you talk about second chances and words like liberation and freedom, it's so beautiful and it's so necessary. So can you talk about what it means for someone to be able to have citizenship, to be given access to immigrate without being vilified?
You know, of course my life has changed since the day I stepped out of Sudan. It's never been really the same. So to be given an opportunity and come to this part of the world as a refugee and be naturalized as an American citizen, it can only create more opportunity for me to speak about two different countries that I know very well. You know, I'm in a crossroad of two countries. When we talk about a refugees and immigrants issue, you know, this is not an issue of those refugees and immigrants. And now it become, you know, the issue of for human race, because there's so much that is happening where people are really just flowing from country to country. And when you are running away from a danger, you know, you can make all kind of decisions. And it's because the situation is dire where they are. But it is not that, you know, life is easy here, but compared to where, you know, living in the refugee camps is, of course, it's completely different. So after you come here, and then you have to start all over again. You have to learn from scratch. You have to learn the language of the people, the culture of the people. You have to go to school. You have to have, it has taken me at least about 24 years to get myself on the ground. And I can only imagine those who are coming from Sudan, South Sudan now, and Syria, and many other places, because there's over 65 million people that are not having a home worldwide.
65 million.
65 million, yeah. And the number is always growing and growing because of wars. So much to do, so much to learn.
So let's talk about going home. What is home to you?
Our home is wherever I'm accepted by the people. And I find a home here in New York City, living here for 12, 13 years now. I have thousands of people in Harlem, thousands of people in Brooklyn, here in Manhattan. So I felt like I find a home here. But also home is where your family is. And then each time I really go back with the current civil war in my country, I go to refugee camp to find my siblings. And then refugee camps too become my home still. So in a sense, I'm still a refugee, even if I'm a US citizen.
I remember when we last saw each other, it was right before your brothers were coming.
Yes.
And the anticipation of your brothers coming to America, and they were gonna go through what you had gone through, and the discussion we had about everything they were gonna see and feel. What was that like for you to guide them through that process?
It'd been a fantastic experience for me, because now I get to revisit my own journey through them. So when I'm looking at them and then the way they are receiving America, that's the way that I was receiving it. So first time that, you know, I get to be with my brothers and do Christmas with them since they were born. First Christmas ever, it was this year. And also they came as an adult, you know. Other one is 24, the other one is 30. And then they are well-developed, grounded young men. It's this sense of humor that they are having about America. It's just, I've been having a blast just laughing. Because each time I ask a question, it's like I know how they're going to feel, how they're going to describe America. So it's a good opportunity for them to be here. And also it's a good opportunity for me to study them so that I can bring back the old memories of who I was. But not only that, you know, them being here now, you know, it's like the weight that been in my shoulders lifted a little bit. Now I can focus a little bit on what I can really do in the sense of my creative projects. And I work closely with Humanity Helping Sudan, which is a foundation that is founded by another lost boy of Sudan from my own village. His name is Manyang. He's a guy with an incredible story, and then he found this coffee. It's called 734 Coffee, and then it's a coffee that brought it from the regions where refugees reside, you know, in our area, in the region of Gambela in Ethiopia. So we bring the coffee here, and then we initiate a lot of conversation on how to make a difference. And then our coffee become one of the best coffee that many people, we get to talk about the refugees issue. And also we take 80% of the proceeds and keeping some of the students who are living in Ethiopia and Kenya and Uganda, we keep them in the school by paying their school fees, because they are in it. Some of them they're in college, some of them they're in high school. So that's one way that we've been working, me and Manyang, to really help those who left behind.
Well, there's a saying, whoso saves a life saves the world entire. So you, my dear friend, care. You, my dear friend, are speaking, and you, my friend, are traveling the globe, shedding light on this tragedy. So now that you have the opportunity to use your voice to call attention, what would your call to action be for any listener? Young and old, teacher, student, child, parent, what is your call to action for humanity?
There's so much that people have to know. There's so much that, so many decisions that can be made by the local authority from so far away that can make a big difference in a negative or in a positive way to someone that is living somewhere in a refugee camp. If you have an authority close by your area, you can speak to them about the refugees issue, you know, and you can always reach out to us on 734, you know, if you want to make a difference individually. You know, let's have our children get to know that there's other places that are going through devastation, and then they can really learn. I think everybody should be a bit more open to a lot of things. All of us together can do something, and I think it's very important for all of us to understand that, yes, as big as the world is, it is also small. There's so much information that are out there that all of us should try to get involved and just try to learn and maybe speak one voice on how to bring this issue to the table, and then they can be discussed properly. It's okay to risk everything about your life. If you want to learn something, you gotta risk everything.
In honor of their truth, may we all narrate our own story. That concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier and our associate producer, Clay Amontorp. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends and leave us a review. Help us spread the word, share hope, and most importantly, help us pass the message of freedom so that we can lift, we can learn, and we can live our stories to the fullest. Our call to action today is this. May we initiate conversations about how to make a difference. May we teach our children how big the world is. And as our guest, Gare Duaney, dares to dream, may we make a home where everyone feels accepted. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told. Hi, folks. It's Erin Gruel. Thank you so much for listening to the show. We're so grateful you keep coming back for more impactful stories from Freedom Writers, Freedom Writer teachers, and our extraordinary guests. This is just a friendly reminder that we have now switched to a bi-weekly release schedule for the summer. During our busy Teacher Institute season, we'll be bringing you episodes every other Monday instead of every single Monday. But stay engaged with us online to see what we're up to and keep an eye out for more substantive content. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And while you're there, leave us a comment or even send us a message. We look forward to staying connected with you and helping you make a difference.